What's the biggest issue right now that we are seeing on college campuses?
I think the thing that stands at the center of two interrelated problems is the American tenure system. The two problems are the crisis of employment amongst American scholars and professors on the one side, and the other problem is the very, very poor quality of undergraduate pedagogy and teaching in the classroom. Those are the two problems, and tenure is kind of clustered right at the center of it all.
How so?
Well, our tenure system has fallen into disrepair. For those in your audience that don't really understand what that is, basically what it is you get 6 years as a scholar to prove your mettle, and if you do, by publishing a lot of research, you get tenure, which means lifetime employment, a decent salary, academic freedom, protections, yada, yada, yada. The problem is the system is in collapse. It used to be around 50% in the 70s. It's down to 25%, and it's sinking. So it means there are a lot of really good scholars out there that are underpaid, underemployed, mistreated. They lack these academic freedom protections. And the thesis of my book, if you wish to call it that, is that this has tangible consequences for undergraduates in the classroom, especially at the elite universities, oddly enough.
So it's not something that is unique to schools strapped for cash, state universities in particular.
Sometimes the problem is exacerbated. It's actually worse at your top 50 schools than it might be at a school ranked 150 to 200. We have to get into the weeds a little bit there, Jim, so I'll let you follow up and tell me what you think is interesting or important about that.
Well, you believe that tenure is a good thing and that more professors should have it and that it would improve higher education, but yet in your book you note that only 8% of the professors at Stanford of all places, are tenured.
No, that's not the statistic is something like this. Only 8% of, I think it's 7% of the faculty at Stanford is contingent.
Okay, right? So, I got you.
Stanford is a great example, right? I've never quite understood why their number is so low. At the typical American university, 60 to 70% of your faculty are contingent. That means they're not even on the tenure track. I'm very worried about those folks, all right, because they are serious scholars who are professionally disrespected and mistreated. And this leads to the next chain in the causal link, or the next link in the causal chain, really, really stressed out folks in the classroom, not able to focus on students. Right? So that's how the tenure system, whatever we do with it, we have to rethink it in a manner that it serves both students and scholars. And right now it's doing neither.
All right, so Stanford is a classic example of what you're talking about. But there are other schools, and as you note, the great lights of higher education in our country, like Harvard, for example. The number's much higher there of contingent professors, isn't it?
Exactly. So your typical American faculty, particularly your elite faculty, is going to have a two-tier division, which is pretty appalling, between the happy and robust tenure line people and the non-tenure line people, all right? And it's basically, we're about 7-3 on most campuses, 6-4, the underemployed towards the very well-employed. The problem is that hidden within that statistic is that those who are on the happy tenure line are often excused from teaching responsibilities. So they get to go do research, they get to kind of nest in an archive. I can get it with STEM disciplines, Jim. I have a very hard time understanding why this prevails in humanities disciplines, right? I don't quite know why we need to do as much research as that when we're tenured, when really the humanities, we're not getting to truth. I mean, we're not discovering cures for diseases. We're getting to truths, or thinking about the way truths compete with one another. So the crisis is particularly acute in the humanities. In STEM, a lot of the problems I'm speaking about are far less pronounced.
877-217-5757 if you'd like to talk in our time with Jacques Berliner-Blau. He's a professor at Georgetown. His book is Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. And you note that at UC Berkeley is a great school. About half of the PhD students' score is depressed. Is that depression related to the academic rigor, or is it perhaps related to the quality of instruction, or both?
In my book, I actually bust out into a fiction, and I'm telling a fictional story about a graduate student who's putting in his decade. On average, it's 10 years it takes to get your doctorate and how his mental health completely falls apart. Why does it happen? It's interesting. I think the nature of research in the liberal arts, especially in the humanities, is about solitude. It's about isolating yourself from everyone, furrowing into an archive, removing yourself from concerns that basically everybody else has. I believe this takes its toll on a person's mental health. Now, let's think again. Let's draw that pivot between the professor and the student. After 10 years of the typical doctoral experience, you come out of there, I believe. I've been through it twice, by the way. I have two doctorates, sir. So you can just imagine what I was like when I got out the second time. You come out of this really incapable of dealing with other human beings. That's what I found, right? You completely lack emotional intelligence. You're obsessed with your micro field of specialization. And this does not conduce to being a good undergraduate teacher because all those skills have been ruthlessly expunged or kicked out of you after that 10-year period in which you probably became clinically depressed, or at least the odds are really high that something mentally went wrong there.
You write, Dr. Berliner-Blau, that all colleges are intent on paying the least while getting the most from their faculty.
Right. A lot of
all
labor,
colleges.
Oh, yeah. A lot of labor historians and people and economists are looking at this, and I was struck by one in the book who said the problem is that colleges and universities have this one priority, and the priority is driving teaching costs down to their absolute lowest level. And that's not the professor's fault. I blame professors for a lot of things in this book. I call us fuddy-duddies. All right? We've made our mistakes, there's no doubt. But that is clearly decisions made by our administrative overlords who have just decided for whatever reasons that the teaching component isn't that important. If you're a parent paying $250,000 in tuition to have your son or daughter attend an elite school, I think you ought to know that about the institution that you're going to send him or her to.
Now, you're at Georgetown, which, like many great higher education institutions, is considered to be a liberal enclave. But you say there is a significant presence of what you call the radical left on American college campuses. What do you mean?
The radical left. People want to think of what happens on American college campuses in terms of the red-blue, Republican-Democrat, conservative-liberal binary. And there are actually three major actors on an American college campus, and let's review them, right? Conservatives are almost non-existent, especially in the humanities, and I find this deeply troubling. I really do, even though I'm not a conservative myself. They're just not there. In the book, I cite some statistics about how unlikely you are to find a conservative in an English department or cinema studies department. Then there's a larger cohort of liberals, and the liberals are graying and kind of getting a little bit tired. And then there's, especially at an elite school, a much larger group of what we would call folks on the radical left. The first thing I want to emphasize, Jim, is that these are serious scholars. Right? We're not talking about people that somehow got there through a connection. I mean, these are very kind of, you know, these people take what they do quite seriously. The problem is, on every American college campus, especially the elite ones, especially in these liberal arts departments, there's this imbalance, right, between the types of worldviews that people have. And I think when the free speech controversies erupt, as they seem to be doing every week, it's incorrect to see it as a liberal versus conservative thing. It's often a radical left versus a liberal controversy that has developed, because liberals don't traditionally like trigger warnings. We don't like speaker boycotts. We're made very uncomfortable by safe spaces, and I think people should realize that.
Professor, you know that in the 1970s, about 56% of American professors were either tenured or on the tenure track, and today it's half that and continuing a downward trend. What's been the biggest catalyst for the drastic shift?
Jim, it's what we discussed earlier, I think. I think colleges have realized that tenuring a human being is really expensive. I priced it out in the book. It's basically every tenure-line professor you see in the United States has a roughly $3 to $5 million 30-year investment by a school. And because we've made some mistakes, I want to be clear about that, I don't think we've often performed optimally. Many trustees and powerful people and politicians, especially at state universities, are starting to ask themselves, do we need to devote that much funding to one person so that they can teach Belarusian poetry in the classroom for 30 years. And that's where the problem is. So the tenure lines are drying up, and it's creating a crisis whose reverberations are felt by students. Strangely enough, parents don't seem to realize this. I'm imploring them in the book to look more carefully at this issue.
You say that most of these associate professors who have tenure are not happy. Why aren't they happy if they've got what amounts to lifetime security?
It's the funniest thing, right? So again and again, survey data reveals that the unhappiest cohort amongst the tenure ranks are the associate professors. Those are the freshly tenured people. Those are people looking at 25 to 50 years of guaranteed lifetime employment. I can see your audience rolling its eyes. And on every criteria, they're the least happy. All right. So it suggests probably that our way of configuring our workplace, our HR protocols, are hopelessly askew. And we need to radically rethink the American professorate in a way that lets more people make a decent living. That's very important to me, and that better serves undergraduates.
Well, it is a compelling book, and I'm sure in our city where we originate the show, in Baton Rouge, with a lot of people who work on the college campuses of Southern and LSU, the book will have great relevance. It's Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students, from Jacques Berliner-Blau. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you so much, Jim. That was a lot of fun.